This tape is being recorded at the City of Berwick offices. My name is Deborah Stefan. The date is the 10th of May 1991, and I'm setting up for an interview with Mr. Max Pawsey, Chief Engineer with the City of Berwick from 1973 to 1988. Firstly, I was wondering if we can begin with something about your background. If you could tell me when you first started with the City of Berwick, and do you have any associations with Berwick before you started to work here?
Not directly. To me, Berwick was always that pretty little village on the hill when you went down to Gippsland. Until I saw the position advertised with the Severance that they wanted a city engineer at the time, and we were interviewed in the November of, I applied for the position, that was in the October, and we were interviewed in the November of 1973, and Pat Northeast and I were appointed at the same time, the same meetings. We both used to travel from our then locations of employment to council meetings. Pat officially took up his appointment prior to Christmas 1973, with work I had to do at Coburg at the time where I came from, I had a bit to tidy up there, so it was current. So I didn't actually arrive at Berwick until the 14th of January 1974.
And what was your working background prior to that appointment?
Prior to that, I had 8 years as city engineer of the City of Coburg. Then prior to that, 3 years at deputy shire engineer at the Shire of Doncaster and Templestowe, which is of course now a city. Prior to that again, 3 years as deputy city engineer at Coburg. Prior to that, approximately 7 years at the City of Preston, as originally just as an engineer and then as the works engineer there at the City of Preston. And prior to that again, I commenced my employment actually in 1952, in the January 1952, at the City of Moorabbin, when it was the most rapidly developing municipality in Melbourne on the urban fringe. And I worked there for just on 3 years, and then went to Preston. Started as a draftsman in the office, and then left there as, I think, an engineering assistant at the time.
Did your family have any background in working for local government?
Yes, my father was a deputy electrical engineer at Coburg when he died in 1957. He'd worked most of his working life, excepting for a short stint with the SEC, where he was released from Coburg so that he could get a power station and similar experience there. He'd worked all his working life in local government, basically, and had a brother who worked at Coburg initially, became rate collector there, and then accountant, and from the accountant position there he went as deputy secretary to the MAV, and eventually he was chief executive and secretary of the MAV.
Do you recall the interview for the original position with the City of Derry?
Yes, to some extent. It's some 17 years ago now. You tend to remember some parts of those sorts of interviews.
Anything that stands out in your mind? Or?
I think one of the things that stood out in my mind at the time, I was very impressed with the calibre of the councillors. They were obviously very keen to get on with the job of setting up a new city. And at that time they were promoting as well Development Corporation ideas, which meant that you eventually not only were the engineer of the city, but also the Development Corporation, which was set up. And so that was a new challenge. But the main reason I actually applied for the position was that when I made inquiries about what had happened out here, or what was happening, it was largely development of the area based on the fact that the Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works at the time, as the planning authority, had determined to release substantial areas out here for development as a government initiative. And when I made some inquiries, I found that it was still basically all grazing land, and people were, developers were buying properties on the basis of complete grazing properties, and from that I recognised that this was going to be the last chance Melbourne had to do some decent planning.
So you were attracted to that opportunity?
Well, that was really the key issue, because what most people don't understand is that the standard of urbanisation you can get is dependent on the land use pattern or the size of subdivision that's permitted prior to it becoming urban. Now, the classic examples are Doncaster and Templestowe, because it was an orchard area and people could make an economic living off 20 acres of orchard, 5 hectares in 8 hectares in modern language, everything tended to be subdivided into those 20-acre allotments. And that meant that when people started to subdivide them, you couldn't even get a decent road pattern in.
Right.
These are the sort of issues that are tremendously important in the long term. You get the hills area and the Dandenongs, for example, where people with berry fruits and potatoes and the like were able to make a reasonable living off 5 acres, off a couple of hectares. So you're dealing with a mass then of these smallish subdivisions, and the standard of urbanisation can be quite low because of those sorts of issues.
Do you recall your early impressions of this area when you first came to work out here?
It's a bit of a difficult question. Early impressions, it was a delightful area as far as scenery was concerned. But the other major issue was, of course, that I'd come here as the first city engineer, and I had the responsibility of all of the planning and development functions as well. That's the physical ones. That we knew, of course, we were going to change it. So my objective really was that any change had to be the best we could possibly make. And when the Development Corporation idea failed, it meant then it all had to be done by negotiated planning. And it was always an effort to get the best standard for the people who were going to live here in the future. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't always easy to get, but we won most of the battles, primarily because council were very supportive of good standards. That's the council as a whole. We managed to achieve it, particularly things like underground power, which council agreed to insist on from day one. And it's just proven to be such a correct decision some 17 or 18 years later that everybody is envious of the fact that the majority of the city has got underground power. And the economies that it brings to the community overall, as far as the financial ones, as well as accident severity and the visual ones that are associated with it, but that's just a principle of the situation. The area really had five small settlements of Berwick, Arkaway, Narre Warren, very little at Narre North really. You can't say it was really substantial in those days. Hallamond was dubbed and was the major area developed around the establishment of the major industries there, providing a workforce for them. And the actual town planning of Dubton is not all that bad as far as the basic planning concepts are concerned. It's got quite a high level of open space, about 14%. But its one weakness was when they planned it, they didn't look beyond the Dubton area. It was Housing Commission of the day, as far as the traffic needs were concerned. So it has a couple of weaknesses in the traffic area, primarily Power Road and Kidd Road, which eventually should be opened through into Endeavour Hills to take the pressure off Power Road.
I understand that during the first year of the operation of the council, there was some controversy over whether the Loader and Bailey report should be accepted or not. I was just wondering what your opinion was of that report and how much of it do you think was implemented in succeeding years?
Right, the Loader and Bailey report, Loader and Bailey were originally employed by the Shire of Berwick, and they did almost a regional concept report for the Shire on the principles of how the Shire should look at development through it, with the western area, of course, which became the city of Berwick, being the one under pressure at the time for urbanisation. And they looked at the system not that dissimilar to the principles of the establishment of Helsinki, which is like beads on a string, with interurban breaks between. And, the idea was quite good and quite sound, and part of that planning pressed for an interurban break between Hallam and Narre Warren. The idea being to cease Melbourne's development there and then start off these beads on the string as you went down the transport corridor. They were the principles behind it. Then the city was established, and the city then re-employed Loader and Bailey to look at the planning of the urban area, and so those basic principles were taken into account as part of the planning process. Loader and Bailey, I feel, produced a plan that was probably ahead of its time for the other planning in Australia at the time, but fairly compatible with the Newtown planning of the UK, where they'd had some experience, I think, and by inquiry they'd seen some of it. And I think John Loader, in fact, went overseas as part of the process, starting, I think, in the Shire's time. But he looked at not only that, but particularly transport systems, and in their planning they came up with a transport system which they termed personalised automated transport, and it was based on an elevated system in principle that would have a pad system on which people could put a car and automatically transferred to the other location they wanted to go to. But of course the one weakness in this sort of system, though it was being looked at overseas at the time, and there are some of these systems in existence today, quite a number more going in, though most of them are pedestrian type systems rather than vehicle type at the present time. The issue really was that you couldn't achieve it in Berwick if it wasn't achieved in the rest of Melbourne. And regrettably, Melbourne's poor planning in the past has meant that it's very restrictive to those sorts of systems going in for the whole of the city. So that was a weakness in it. The other major recommendation that was sort of well ahead of its time, but a bit in keeping with moves by state and federal governments of the day, was the idea of a development corporation. And that proved eventually not to be politically acceptable. And for two reasons. One, the timing of the report, there was some political naivety in the part of the consultants, and I think on the part of some of the councillors who pushed for the report to come out in the July 1974, prior to the August elections, which meant that the interim reports were available, and so those who were against the principle had the information available to them well ahead of the publishing of the report. So an anti-lobby was set up, and well, it effectively divided the community on a 50-50 basis. So with those issues, it didn't proceed, of course, and that meant then that we had to fall back on standard planning procedures. We were very fortunate at the time in that the developers, Lewis Land, the developers of Endeavour Hills, had already obtained a planning permit from the Shire and had commenced some of their development. When they attended the public meetings that followed their start up there, when we were trying to educate the public as to what the planning was about for Berwick, it apparently impressed them, because they came back to council and said, look, what we're planning isn't good enough, take back our planning permit. We've employed Loader and Bailey and other consultants, and here's a new concept, give us a new planning permit to much better standards. And that was terribly important, because it meant that they were putting properties on the market at somewhere, I'd say 85-87% of the standards we were trying to achieve under the Loader and Bailey plan. And in them producing their development to that standard, it meant everybody else to compete with them had to come up to the same standard. So we were very fortunate that in fact that we had a very understanding developer at Endeavour Hills.
What were the principles on which you and the people with you implemented planning over the years? Was there another plan then that took the place of this one to establish the principles, or were you, as you say, going back on standard?
No, we had to introduce a new plan, because part of the Loader and Bailey plan attempted to have the Gippsland Freeway system moved to south of the area that was to be developed in Berwick. And the reason for that was that, of course, the development corridor was already divided with the railway line and the Prince's Highway, and to have, pardon me, a freeway following those and adjacent to them for quite a long length through the developed area or developing area really is a difficult thing to plan around. And so their theory was to have the road diverted down where the South Gippsland freeway goes now, and then come off to the south of the developed area and skirt around that way, and then go back up at Officer. towards the corridor system again. That didn't succeed. The Country Roads Board of the day had already obtained something like 90% of the reservation for the other road, and based on that the council eventually agreed to support the retention of the freeway in that location. So that meant the whole of the layout of the road system and everything for the Loader and Bailey plan had to be altered. And so what we did at that stage, there had been a transport study conducted as part of the Loader and Bailey plan, and that had been done by Mike Taylor at Monash University, who was doing his PhD on network analysis. We re-employed Mike, that's the city, following a new analysis of the road system, which we did internally, of course. We worked out a new network of roads that would be required based on retaining the freeway, and we had Mike reanalyse all of this work and produce a totally new concept in transport or traffic design, which, following all of his work, and all of it based on the development of Berwick, has now become standard procedure in transport and traffic analysis, and that's based on generation of traffic from the household. Even if you're in business and you go to work, before you go to work, you in fact plan where you're going with your vehicle. You know where you're going to become a pedestrian on any trip, where you're going to park the car and then walk to either visit somebody, purchase something, keep appointments, etc. So all of really your trip planning does occur from the home, and that's been well proven now, and so that was the basis of it. And the principle of the approach is that once you determine what your zoning's going to be, you can determine how many allotments approximately you'll finish up within each zoning, and from that you can then project the likely traffic on your arterial roads. Now, as part of the planning, we stuck with the cell plan principles that Loader and Bailey had established, with them having a focus around a primary school with the concentration of open space adjacent to it, corner store, preschool, and if there was an infant welfare, which had been about every second cell, one of those as well. And with that sort of a focus, eventually it meant that people, for their daily needs, would do about 20-25% of their work journeys or trips from the household would occur internally in the cell, and therefore you would save that additional loading on your arterial road system, which of course is the problem in the other parts of Melbourne. And the end result of that was that we were able to actually project on 6.72 vehicle trips per day per household reaching the arterial road instead of between 9 and 11. The interesting thing was, in 1987 we had Dr. Mike Taylor do a reassessment on the time basis, and our traffic projections were within 1% on a time basis, 15 years after the original study. So it's pretty well proven itself to be satisfactory. But the value of this is that back in the greenfield situation, the greenfield days, you can determine the order of magnitude of each of your arterial roads, how many lane capacities you should provide, the width of your reservations, how you should restrict the access, and all of these things. And so we're able to determine, back in 1974-5, the vehicle capacity requirements of the whole of the arterial road system, design the locations where the intersections should be out of each cell by doing a rough longitudinal design of the with the arterial roads and being able to say that a road's got to be either at a crest or in a sag, so that but preferably on a crest with a long flat curve, so that all the best safety features could be included. The interesting thing too, in those days we were insisting on right angle intersections with traffic signalisation at an early stage to handle the turning movements on about a kilometre to kilometre and a half spacing. And of course the pressure of the day was for staggered T intersections, which have very low capacity environments because of the staggering of the turning movements, and those sorts of systems are safer, but they're only really achievable on lower order roads internally within the cells, and of course we use those systems internally but not on the arterials. And we had some interesting criticism on some planning appeals about the way we went, and everything we did proved to be totally correct, because the whole traffic industry has now recognised the fact that now they can control traffic better. The only way to go is right angle intersections.
Was this cell development, was this adopted from some other municipality?
No, it actually followed the principles that were used in the English new towns in the main, and their systems, of course, are a stage better than ours, because they've been able to segregate all pedestrian movements totally from the road movements, with overpasses and underpasses. We couldn't afford that, or the developers claimed they couldn't afford it. We only achieved one underpass, and that's on James Cook Drive in Dever Hills. But the developers claimed that it was very, very expensive, but that one in fact also acts as an overflow in very extreme storm conditions, which we've never seen flood yet in 17 years, but that's in the hydrology design for the area. But that's where the theories came from. And one of the interesting things in town planning, pretty well all the best town planning of this century has come from England, but it's been adopted by others and developed even further by others, particularly in Scandinavia and some in America. But the English have done some good work, but not quite to the standards that some others have promoted their theories.
Was there some benefit in you being employed not only as the city engineer but also in charge of planning? Did you have that dual role?
Yes, and the responsibility for building and council buildings as well. The important issue with all these things is that when you set up processes administratively, that the whole system has to flow. One of the most important aspects to urbanisation is how you handle traffic. 30 years ago I did an analysis of local government, and I felt it had three basic problems. One was the crazy way it was restricted in those days, just to raising its funds from a rate on land base. The second issue was going to be traffic, and the third issue was going to be waste disposal. And all I know is that after 30 odd years that those opinions haven't changed. But the important thing with planning is that it's not just determining what the land will be used for, but how you service that land properly, with the physical services as well as coping with the traffic that development generates. And when you put that then into the planning scene, once you've got that skeleton set down, you can then plan the detailed infills. And of course, when developers come on the scene, they want the process to be carried out as quickly as possible. That's the development process for their land, so that others can then build on it. But in a number of cases, we had a combination between developers and builders. Jennings were an example where they built their own, but many other developers tied in with one or several builders who built on their land. And so all of the processes had to be as speedy as possible once the decision was made. And we found the major issue was to spend the time in the initial negotiations with them, determining what the standards ought to be and why, give them the details, and once those hurdles were over, then the formal processes should be as swift as possible. But one of the things that we used to do, nearly half the cells that were to be developed in the city turned out to be under single ownership. So you're only dealing with one developer.